Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I'm thrilled we have a fabulous show for you today. We had an amazing Grand Rounds talk at our place several months ago, and I immediately said we have to have this amazing physician on ACRAC, and I'm so glad that she agreed to come on. And so today we're going to talk about post-op delirium with Dr. Michelle Humaden. She is a professor of anesthesiology at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. She's a clinician scientist and a practicing neuroanesthesiologist. Her research focuses on preclinical and clinical studies of central nervous system aging with the overall goal of optimizing perioperative management of older patients to facilitate the best possible functional recovery after surgery for these patients. She serves as the medical director for the Multidisciplinary Enhanced Surgical Recovery Program at OSU, and she is the site PI for the multi-center SCOPE trial, Sleep, Cognition, and Pain versus ERAS Cardiac for post-op delirium funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, also known as PCORI. Thrilled to have her here. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to speak with you.
Awesome. Well, tell me a little bit about how you got interested in post-op delirium in the first place.
So I really got interested in this as a medical student toward the end of my clerkship time, which I did at the MD-PhD program at the University of Kentucky. So that was an 8-year, run that was the traditional 2 years of kind of classroom based. And then I went to the lab for 4 years. And then the last 2 years I was back, doing my clerkships. And I did my PhD in neuroscience. I already had that kind of lens that I brought back to the clinical time. But I just got first of all, I loved anesthesia. I mean, as soon as I got the chance to try it, I was just totally enamored with everything about the OR and just all of the dynamics of it. And what really got me interested in delirium was all the focus on optimization that was being taught to me and I was hearing about as a student observing the anesthesiologists, but they never talked about the brain. It was always about, the other organ systems. And I just thought that was so just odd. I didn't know what to make of that. And at the time, it really seemed like the general vibe around delirium was like, well, of course we're going to have some confusion after, grandma has a big surgery. And wow, that has like really changed over time. And now we recognize that, that's not something that we should just, accept or, we shouldn't try to intervene on and do much better for. But yeah, that just disconnect really struck me when I was a student and I got so interested in that and have carried it on since then.
Very cool. And that is, as you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, wow, in many ways, it's still that way. We think really hard about the cardiac optimization and, what's their cardiac function? Did they have an echo? How can we optimize that? How can we avoid problems with the, blood pressure? We think a lot about cardiac pulmonary, but interestingly, even now, I think we don't do a whole lot of talking about the brain and how we can prevent decline and how we can prevent damage to the brain other than thinking about blood pressure and perfusing the brain. So it's, I think really great that you're doing this work because I think there's still a lot of work to do. Let's talk about post-op delirium. How prevalent is it? Why? I mean, obviously it goes without saying, but let's just say, why do we care? Why do we want to prevent it?
Well, it's starting to be referred to as the most common complication after surgery in older patients. And I think that's, a pretty appropriate way to describe it because it is really common. Certainly more common than other things that we focus on in the consent, like, mortality or, airway injury, things like that, anaphylaxis, right? It's way more common than all of those things. But it really depends on a lot of factors, what someone's risk would be predicted to actually be for post-op delirium. In general, I think somewhere around 20 to 25% of all older adults presenting for elective surgery are at risk. And then if it's major, very invasive surgeries, that risk goes up. If it's emergency surgery, no matter what variety, that risk goes up as well. And then there's definitely patient factors that affect that too. So, in general, you'll see somewhere between 5 to 10% in really straightforward routine things without a lot of, case or patient associated factors that could increase risk, all the way up to 50 or 60% in cardiac or vascular surgery, and high numbers like that, like I said, for emergency. So it's really variable, but it's certainly common. Yeah.
And, you know, again, it seems like sounds bad, but why do we not want people to have this, right? Is it, you know, we also don't want people to, you know, I don't know, wake up wild and yelling, but if they do, fine, right? Like, okay, we'll deal with it. So why is this something we really want to try to prevent?
This is something we want to prevent for a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, just on its baseline level, it's distressing, you know, not only to the patient and their family, but also the, you know, the care team that's providing for them. So it's just distressing all the way around. It's associated with worse outcomes for sure. So the risk of having, you know, those are kind of acute complications and longer term things too. So, you know, in the acute setting, a delirious patient's going to be in the hospital longer. There is a great, by the way, I'll do a plug real quick for the ASA Monitor in June. It has some excellent articles in it that are all about this type of stuff. And we have some surgeon colleagues that contributed an article too, and they have some cool data on emergency versus non-emergency risk for delirium and different types of surgeries that's worth checking out. So I'm thinking about that as we're talking today. Nice. But, you know, we should definitely care, because if they have delirium, their risk of being in the hospital is longer. They have a higher likelihood of going to some other type of facility besides home, and discharge to home is, you know, definitely something we really want to prioritize for folks when that's available and appropriate. And then, you know, longitudinally, the risk of having cognitive issues, you know, onset, new onset, or even kind of a more steeper trajectory of decline, you'll see that as a risk that's associated with postoperative delirium. I mean, those studies aren't perfect, but there definitely seems to be some risk that's in the acute setting and longitudinal risk. So we should care for all those reasons, definitely.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. And it seems like the people who get post-op delirium, tell me if I'm right here, most, but not all, will recover from a kind of a get back to baseline where they were from a, you know, mental performance standpoint, but not all, right? Some will never get back. And do we know how common that is, that people who get post-op delirium don't ever fully recover back to where they were pre-surgery?
You know, I actually tried to find some information on that, and I kind of struck out a little bit. I don't have a lot of good numbers that can say, like, this is the exact risk. We know the risk goes up, but I don't have, like, an exact, you know, kind of conversion for sure to offer. I think that, you know, in general, the overall concern is present, because we don't have the best way of predicting who has that lower risk. You know, they get delirium, and like you said, I totally agree. Like, most of the time they recover, might delay. It's definitely going to delay their time in the hospital, and it's going to increase costs and stuff, but you know, they recover, and the long-term issues are not there. That's the case most of the time. But what's the difference? You know, how do we know those folks from the ones that do go on to have, you know, significant challenges long term? That's something we don't have a good handle on, as far as I know.
Yeah, interesting. It seems like this is something we don't really know exactly what causes it. You mentioned the cardiac surgery, it's much higher risk. And so you might think duration of surgery, you might think invasiveness of surgery, duration of anesthesia. But do we know? Is it the anesthesia? Is it the surgery? Is it how long you have those things for? Or do we not know?
I think the short answer is all of the above. I think that it's definitely multifactorial, and that's a little bit frustrating in the sense of it doesn't bring a lot of like clarity to what we can do to prevent it or intervene on it. But it's definitely multifactorial. To be the type of delirium that we're talking about postoperatively, you really do need to rule out some of the physiologic things that could be causing that, derangements and, you know, their laboratory values or different aspects of, you know, their medications that might be contributing to things. There's kind of all those things set aside, the features of delirium still being present is kind of the type that we're talking about. So sometimes delirium, you know, can be caused by these post-operative fluctuations in, you know, their labs and their medicines and all of that. But those things resolved, delirium that still persists is really hard to know where it comes from. There's definitely, like you said, a surgical association. So, you know, it's pretty, I don't know. My area of expertise is not the inflammatory aspect of post-op delirium, but that is certainly something that is becoming more and more clear is playing a major role in this. And not just, inflammatory response kind of in the brain, but also out in the body. And that certainly goes with invasiveness of surgery and just the type of derangements that come along with very invasive surgeries and the inflammatory kind of pathways and characteristics that they set into emotion. I mean, those things are becoming more and more tied to delirium for sure. And as far as other things that cause it, really what we're left with is what the patient comes to the gate with, and how much, I really believe, and this is going to kind of get over into my research bias, but I really believe that all of those insults, you know, the inflammation, the invasiveness of the surgery, the medications, the physiologic derangements, what patients come to surgery with can help them weather that storm and whether they, what kind of reserve that they have, will really determine, I think, their overall outcome, whether they get delirious, how severe it is, and if there's long-term sequelae from it. So that's a long answer for what causes it, but it really is, it's complex.
Yeah.
It's really complex. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, is it fair to say that we can't really say that general anesthesia, as opposed to, let's say, regional anesthesia, put you at higher risk? I mean, I'm thinking about the Regain trial and, do you agree with that? Do you think that it's likely that while anesthesia might play a role, it's not clear that it's like one type of anesthesia versus another?
Yeah, there's definitely been so much good literature and expert consensus and recommendations come out in the past several years to kind of help guide us. So it's really a great time in the literature for this space. And one of the things that definitely, gets called out a lot is that we don't have clear evidence that one particular type of anesthetic approach is clearly better than another. And that goes for general versus a regional. That also goes for a volatile-based anesthetic versus a TEVA, right? We really don't have evidence to say that there's clear benefit to one of those approaches. So that's population-based, right? I do think for the individual patient that it could matter. And so I think in general, people do make those decisions based on kind of the overall assessment of the patient and their situation. And I think in general, less is more. So if you approach an older patient with, kind of a less is more approach, you want to have, really good pain control, really good hemodynamic management, I think. And outside of that, how you achieve those things, there's no evidence that one way is better than the other. You got to kind of approach each patient.
So. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about risk factors. I mean, the ones we've already discussed are age, obviously, pre-existing cognitive impairment, duration/intensity of surgery on some level. What about frailty kind of divorced from age? In other words, does a 40-year-old extremely frail patient have a higher risk than a 40-year-old not frail patient for post-op delirium?
Yeah, frailty is definitely an independent, risk factor for post-op delirium. And, one of the things that I think is really interesting about the post-op delirium story is the frailty aspect of it, because they're kind of developing together, right? This frailty, really looking out for these high-risk patients before surgery, these high-risk frail patients, because of all the issues that we know them to be at risk for. It's kind of the same story with post-op delirium. They're similar, but also a little bit separated still. But frailty definitely contributes to delirium risk. And I always enjoy reading any of Dan McIsaac's stuff. He's just such a great writer, and he's a frailty expert. And I like And he kind of calls out that, you know, in resource limited environments or in a place where you're trying to start change, you know, that's really different from maybe what the current practice is, frail patients are a good place to start because of that extra risk that they bring to the table. And so if you're really kind of going to get the most bang for your buck, that population is a really good place to start the process or the investment in, and then you can kind of grow from there. So, yeah.
How about anemia? Do we know the answer to that? Does anemia on its own lead to a higher risk of developing post-op delirium? And I ask that because, you know, I think there's more and more data coming out about anemia as an kind of additive or synergistic risk factor with so many other things. So people who are anemic and have diabetes do worse than people who just have diabetes but are not anemic, right? So is it true that people who are have everything else the same and are anemic have a higher risk of post-op delirium than people who have the same other risk factors but are not anemic, or do we not know the answer to that?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. It might be out there, but I just haven't come across it. But I'll tell you, I mean, just to me, it would make sense because, you know, that oxygen carrying capacity piece of the equation is so important. I mean, I think about that in aspects other than this, you know, when I'm wearing my clinical hat, because we do all of this work to support the blood pressure and to give volume and resuscitate people. But if you're not delivering oxygen, you know, it's really those. Yeah. So I do think that anemia is probably an important contributor. And we know that when that gets addressed before surgery, it definitely makes the other outcomes better. So I would think that it would help with delirium, but I don't know that particular literature. So I'll have to investigate, because I think it probably makes sense for sure.
Yeah, great. Okay, let's talk about preoperative cognitive impairment, because I know that's such a strong risk factor. So we know that people who have preoperative cognitive impairment are at higher risk for developing post-op delirium. How can we identify patients who have preoperative cognitive impairment? And I'm more thinking in the short time we might have in like the pre-op area, less. I mean, you can also talk about in pre-op clinic where you have a lot more time and it might be weeks before surgery. But, you know, what if you're just seeing the patient the morning of surgery? Is it worth trying to identify if they have preoperative cognitive impairment? And if so, how can you do it in a short amount of time?
Hey, folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC.
That is a great question. And I will say, yes, it is worth trying to do. You know, there's also a lot of really cool literature coming about over the last few years and even recently about this and how we don't do a good job with this. And it's multifactorial. One is, you know, like, you know, sometimes we are capturing people right before we're heading back to the OR, and how practical is that? And what do we do with that information? And is that the right time to start addressing these types of risks for the first time? That should really be, you know, done earlier on in the process. And then also documenting the screening tests, like in the medical record, so that it can be helpful. But the, you know, those things set aside, I think that it is worth doing. You know, they've shown that, you know, if you do like something very simple, like a mini cog, which takes just a couple of minutes, and there's some great resources that will teach you how to do that and kind of show you how to integrate that into your practice with patients on the Brain Health Initiative for free at the ASA. But, you know, that one in particular has been shown to really perform well, even if it's done right before, like in pre-op holding versus in clinic, it seems to match. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of screeners available. Some take 10 minutes, some take just a couple of minutes. It depends on the situation that you're trying to apply it to. But the benefit of doing it is that if the patient screens positive, it definitely is a good starting point to kind of start redirecting some resources toward them as high risk. So even if it's just as simple as the anesthesia team and the surgical team being aware, and maybe they adjust a few of the medications that they might have given, or you know, they change maybe what bed the patient goes to. They try to get them a room with a window. You know, those types of things are, a lot of hospitals now have kind of geriatric kind of order sets or protocols in place that can make sure, you know, it can just make sure as a check that that is in place for someone that screens positive. So things can happen. They, you know, and people really believe if we do some of this basic stuff that it, we can impact the delirium risk pretty significantly. But it's tough because identifying that risk like right before going back to the OR, when it could have, it's usually short-term consequences, but it could have very serious long-term consequences. That's the part that I think we're struggling with right now, figuring out how to do that better. And that's going to take a team effort between our surgeon colleagues and us and our preoperative clinic folks as well, because that conversation really should be had earlier on when it's, you know, if you're in some emergency surgery, obviously that's tougher. But yeah, I think that's what I'm reading and seeing, and that's the direction our profession is going, trying to push it out further. But even right beforehand, it can help change some key things that could have real impact. So.
Great. Yeah, I think I mentioned to you when we were talking before that we did this whole project when I was a resident years ago, incorporating the animal fluency test into our preoperative charting. So we would have the patients in pre-op try to name as many animals as they could in 60 seconds. And then I don't remember the cutoffs, but this is, you know, this is a published test and it's probably not the best one out there, but it was easy to do. And then what we did was if the patient screened positive, which meant they were at higher risk for having, they may have some pre-op cognitive impairment, so they are higher risk for post-op delirium, we would do things like avoid benzos, recommend that the surgical team put them in a high visibility bed, you know, double check and make sure they had their hearing aids and their glasses and things like that, all the things that kind of both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic that we can do. So what can we do? I mean, you mentioned some of the things, but let's talk about like in the OR. So, or in pre-op in the OR, I guess one question is, does it make sense to not give the kind of standard one or two of Versed to these patients? Do we know? I mean, I'm an ICU doc. Believe me, I know that in the ICU, benzos are bad. They lead to much higher risk for delirium in the ICU. But does the pre-op dose of Versed cause or increase the risk of post-op delirium in anyone, and especially in high-risk patients?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, ACRACers. One thing I love about summer is how easy everything feels. The days are a little more relaxed, and I find myself reaching for the same comfortable go-anywhere pieces again and again. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They focus on well-made essentials that naturally become those everyday staples you actually live in all season long. Quince's 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, easy to throw on, and the summer upgrade your rotation needs, starting at just $34. Their tees are soft enough to live in all day, and the lightweight cotton sweaters are exactly what you want when the summer nights cool down. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, and they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. And it's not just clothing. They have everything from home to travel to everyday essentials. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince. I wear it all the time, and it might be the only thing my wife and daughters actually compliment me on. And it didn't cost anywhere near what I thought it would. Make your summer wardrobe easy. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ACCRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey folks, I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for Austin humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with Figs to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. Figs goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, under scrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try Figs today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout. Hey there, ACRackers. Hunger strikes and you're exhausted. You want to make something healthy, but you don't have the energy. Sound familiar? For me, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem, it's a setup problem. Or it was until I found Factor. Factor solves the setup problem with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs delivered right to your door. My wife and I want to give our kids healthy food that they will actually eat, but we don't have time to cook from scratch. That's why we use Factor, and you should too. Inside your Factor box, you'll find lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole food ingredients, and healthy fats. It's always fresh, never frozen, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Some of our favorites right now are the smoky barbecue chicken breast and the butternut squash sage chicken macaroni. With over 100 rotating weekly meals, there's always something new to look forward to. Plus 70-plus add-ons to round out your nutrition from green juices to peanut butter energy bites. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor, and if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss, you know where to go. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with new subscription only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details.
All right, and we're back.
So this has been something that's been kind of back and forth, you know, to completely avoid, to kind of where it's at, you know, from one where it was like ad lib, right? We didn't change anything about how we cared for an older patient, to complete avoidance at all costs, to where it's settling now, which is I think that, you know, low doses, 1 or 2 milligrams of midazolam, if you feel like the there's benefit for a patient, is probably not, you know, going to put them at a significantly increased risk. That's kind of the latest from the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation and, you know, these best practice, or I don't think those are mentioned in the best practice specifically, but just some of the more current research has kind of said these lower doses, you know, maybe aren't as bad as we might have thought. But that said, again, you know, there's some caveats to that, you know, like when it's given, you know, is giving a milligram of Versed as part of your induction the same as giving a milligram of Versed in pre-op holding, taking their hearing aids and then transporting them in a strange environment to the OR? I don't know. You know, I don't know that we have that answer from our current, you know, studies. So those are the kind of things that I think might actually have real impact that we don't, you know, necessarily have a good way to study. So I think it's totally reasonable to give it if it feels like the right thing for a patient, you know, based on the current situation and what we know about the risk. Like you said, in the ICU, it's a different thing, but definitely long-acting benzodiazepines, I think, are a definite no. Like we can say that anything like that, unless that's like a whole medication or something, we can avoid that perioperatively. Versed's probably okay in low doses, but it's a case-by-case basis. I tend to avoid it. I'll spend a little more time talking to older patients, instead of going with the anxiolytics if I can, to try to help whatever it is that they're stressed about. But if they need it, you know, I think that people should be reassured that it's probably not causing harm in small doses. Yeah.
Great. There's some literature in the ICU that suggests that using dexmedetomidine can maybe delay or prevent the onset of ICU delirium and maybe shorten its course if it happens. Do you think there's a role in high-risk patients for using specifically for this purpose, using dexmedetomidine in the OR?
That is coming out as something that people can definitely consider that might mitigate risk. You know, again, it's like every case has its ups and downs. If you're having a lot of bradycardia and hypotension from it, you know, then it might not be worth it. But there's definitely some evidence to support that dexmedetomidine in the OR could be of benefit. So I think that's worth considering for sure.
Okay. Anything else you recommend people do if they screen someone as high risk because they have preoperative cognitive impairment?
As far as, you know, kind of immediate in the OR and post-op stuff, I think in general, if you really are thoughtful about the medications that you use for nausea prevention, for example, or PACU management. You know, I get a call every once in a while from a paradine and someone that's older, and that's like an absolute no. That's a really good opportunity to use dexmedetomidine, actually, if you're getting called for Rigers on an older person. You know, that's, there's just, you know, especially in some of our more central acting anti-nausea medicines and stuff, scopolamine is another one to really be, I think, careful about, you know, who you're selecting to use that for. Those types of things can really be helpful, I think, in managing these older patients and are pretty practical. If it's appropriate and they're a good candidate for any type of a regional, to not necessarily to avoid a general, but just to supplement the pain management plan, I'm always supportive of that too, because, you know, pain that's not well controlled can cause delirium, and too many opiates or too many, you know, too much other adjuncts that could be sedating can also cause delirium. So you want to kind of strike that balance where their pain is well controlled, but you're not having side effects from, you know, your approach. And I think incorporating regional or neuraxial is a really great way to do that. And you know, like you said, those other practical things, getting them their sensory aids, their teeth as soon as possible, getting them, you know, the type of setting that can help them stay oriented, and, you know, those other kind of best practices can continue out of the OR and to the floor. And that's really, if we do those things consistently, it is very beneficial. Yeah.
Great. Now, I know your work has shown that cognitive prehabilitation may actually be helpful and protective. So tell me a little bit about that, because when you talked about this and when you gave our grand rounds, it was fascinating. So, I mean, I'm sure you could talk for many hours about it, but what are the highlights of how this you're looking at this and how it could help?
Yeah. So same time that I got really fascinated with delirium as a medical student, I got fascinated with the idea of like cognitive reserve and trying to prehabilitate somebody, because I came from a department that was very strong in dementia research. And, you know, there was all this great literature that like an active mind is a protected mind, right? So the more active that you keep yourself, and the better, you know, you'll age from a cognitive standpoint. And I just thought that that was so interesting. And, you know, it was always talked as a longitudinal kind of construct, but I thought around surgery, I mean, it, you know, is, I didn't think it was crazy to believe that maybe we could do some things that would bring some benefit, even though that usually it takes a lifetime, right, to build up or whittle away cognitive reserve. I thought an acute intervention could help. So that's really where the idea came from. And I did a clinical trial, a randomized trial with it. And what I love most about it is it's really low risk. I mean, this is not a pharmacologic intervention. You know, it's one of the few things, I mean, all the stuff we've talked about so far is stuff we do in the OR, stuff we do after surgery. There's not a lot that we can offer patients that they are empowered to go home and do. And that's one of the things I really like about it too, is it gives them a chance to have some agency in their risk, you know, management, if they choose to. And, you know, it's an active area of study right now. I mean, my clinical trial showed a decent reduction in the patients that actually played the games. We had a couple of patients, you know, in our intention to treat analysis that were in our intervention group that didn't play, and they had two of those four had delirium, so it affected our overall statistics. But if you just look at the people that played, they hit about 5 hours in the 10 days or so before surgery. And yeah, the delirium rate went from about 23% down to 13%. So for a behavioral study that was pragmatic, I mean, that's pretty great. So I definitely, you know, don't think, I mean, it's just one study, right? So, but I think based on that and just the risk profile of it, it's definitely exciting that it's been studied more by other folks, and they've also shown benefit in other settings. And I have another trial right now that's looking at it and proposing more trials to try to continue to study this. So yeah, the whole idea is that when the brain has an insult happening, which we talked about, right? All that inflammation, all those medications, all the physiologic changes that come with being in, you know, in surgery and immediately after, The more the brain has to be able to function despite that insult, right? The more redundancy, the more pathways, however you want to look at it, the lower the chance that someone's actual function will be compromised. And so, I don't, you know, it's kind of wild to study something that I don't have a perfect mechanism for. I can't tell you that there's more synapses when they play brain games or anything like that at this point, but I'm trying to figure out ways to study that, to measure the reserve, because it certainly seems like the ones that play have some sort of benefit and it's very low risk. And I think that's that, and it gives them an opportunity to do something within their control. So yeah, that's
yeah, the how cool
story.
And these games are things like memory games. Is it, you know, does crossword puzzles count? Like what counts and what doesn't count for something that you're looking at?
So what I've studied are dynamic computer games. So I use an app called Lumosity. There's other ones that are similar. But what's special about what I've been using is that it is dynamic. So the more, you know, it challenges the person. It's not like a static, you know, interaction. So that's important, I think, to kind of find ways to be challenged, to have novel, you know, kind of exercise as part of it. I think, you know, originally I wanted to study crosswords and like Sudoku and things like that. But practically speaking, it was very difficult to be sure what the patients had actually done or not done as part of the intervention. So I geared myself more towards something that I could measure and actually prove and be sure that they were getting challenged and that it wasn't too difficult or too easy, because it'll also adjust if people aren't performing well. It'll kind of back it down in intensity so that they'll keep, you know, keep engaging with the game. So, they cover different areas of cognition. So there's speed, attention, flexibility, memory. There's some language and math in there too. But the ones I think that are probably the most interesting or most helpful are kind of the attention, speed, flexibility. You know, I'll derail for just a second and go back to where we were talking about the mini-cog. You know, as widespread as that is and as useful as it is, I mean, because we know if people screen positive on the mini-cog, their risk is increased, and that's very helpful. But I really think that we're missing, even still, if we're screening people with that, I still think we're missing some folks that have some cognitive vulnerability that is clinically significant, but we just aren't capturing. And so, you know, some of the things I'm interested with the brain games is maybe teasing some of that out too. So it being a little bit of a prognostic and also a therapeutic, which I think is cool because it's all together
very
in
cool.
One thing. But yeah, I think an active mind is great. You know, patients might not have access to things like tablets and computer games. I really think that's okay. You know, crosswords, reading the newspaper, social interactions, listening to music, writing emails even. These are all versions of things that have been shown to have benefit if you do them regularly. And so I think it's just, again, staying active. And it just so happens that this particular construct has performed well in research settings too.
Yeah,
so.
Very cool. What is the SCOPE trial looking at?
The SCOPE trial is an expansion of the original Neurobics trial that I did. And it's a collaborative effort with me and Beth Israel Deaconess in Massachusetts General, and then also Columbia. The two PIs, Dr. Bala Subramaniam and Lei Gao, they're the PIs on the study. And then I'm the site PI at Ohio State. And then we have Vivek Moitra at Columbia. The study is taking the brain exercises and adding sleep hygiene, coaching, and patient education, and kind of in the preoperative setting to further add cognitive reserve and prehabilitation. That package is being done before surgery with the tablet, again, brain exercises. And then after surgery, there's some opiate sparing pain management aspects of the study. And we are in cardiac surgery, which is different than what I did before. But that population is very high risk. So we really wanted to take this layered approach in that really high risk population, because it's a lot of elements. But, you know, again, it's kind of a lot of things that are low risk, which I think is ideal in this population or any population always, but to be able to have these things layered on, and they're all pretty low risk things, hopefully we'll see a great benefit and it'll actually be something that could be implemented. So that's the SCOPE trial. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, we'll be exciting to see the results. I imagine it'll be a few years before we have that.
Yeah. It'll be a couple years. We are in the middle of enrollment right now. That trial will have 406 patients at the end. We're about maybe about 30% of the way through. So we're well into it, but we've got a ways to go still. So another couple years.
Very exciting. Well, we've talked about some of the kind of things to come. I mean, the SCOPE trial, obviously, you've mentioned the idea of maybe using some games as a diagnostic intervention to try to figure out someone if they have preoperative cognitive impairment based on how they do on a game. I know when we talked before after your grand rounds, there's also the thought of, could you figure out specifically which games or which type of skills are the most protective if you get good at them? So all that's really interesting and exciting. Are there other things that you think are coming down the road in this area of research and in terms of just cognitive protection in general that are exciting we should keep our eyes out for?
Yeah, I think, I definitely think that using dynamic, kind of like self-administered brain exercises is a really interesting thing for the future. Because like you said, the ability for the patients to play some games, and that would be our way of screening them, it could integrate right into our medical record, right? It would kind of solve some of these logistical issues, I think, that have kind of stymied our ability to do this on a bigger scale. And I think that's super exciting. I think sleep and kind of the anti-inflammatory standpoint, I mean, there's just a lot of good pieces coming together. And I think the most exciting thing for the future is that we might have a way to really tailor certain things depending on what the patient's risk profile is. And so it might be a combination of things before or in the OR or more, with after surgery. And because there's so many different things that contribute to delirium, I think the future is really exciting because it's going to continue to kind of chip away at each of those things, and hopefully land us in a place where this is not something that we're dealing with as much. So
very cool. Looking forward to it. All right. Well, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What's something you would recommend the audience check out for fun?
All right. Totally for fun. I came across this book several months ago. I have no idea how I found it. It's just random. And it caught my attention. It was in my Audible, believe it or not. I have no idea how it landed there. I must have thought it was interesting at some point and put it in my library. And I was scrolling through. It's called Many Lives, Many Masters. Is that the name of it? Yeah. And it's about a psychiatrist and his kind of account of just this extraordinary patient encounter that he had in the 80s. And it's fun to read. It's definitely pushes the boundaries, I would say, of what we think of when we think of kind of typical medicine or practice and therapy. But it's fun. It just is fun to think about, like, when you're a scientist or you're a clinician and you have something come to you that just completely challenges your core system of how you have processed things. Like, it's fun. It's a really great story. It's interesting to hear this doc work through this patient experience and kind of all the wild things that she told him and how he handled all that. It's just fun. It's an interesting read. So
very cool. All right. That sounds awesome. I'm going to recommend a TV show called Justified. You can stream it on Hulu. It's a lot of fun. And I will say one of the interesting things about this is that I asked Claude. I told Claude some of the other shows I had liked. And I said, I'm looking for another show to watch. And I'll tell you, I was very impressed. Claude told me, check out Justified. And Claude said, the first season is a little on the slower side and not quite as good, but it's worth making it through because the second season is really much better. And I was kind of almost done with the first season and thinking, I don't know, I might not stick with it. And then I went back and read and I saw, oh yeah, Claude said, and sure enough, I got to the second season and it's really got me hooked now. So both a plug, I guess, for Claude in terms of TV recommendations.
Well done, Claude.
Yeah, exactly. And then Justified, which I think is worth watching if you just get through the first season. It's not that you have to suffer through it. It's fine. But the second season is better.
Awesome.
Well, Michelle, thanks so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Chidima Ikanti, Rachel Furman, and Mohammed Celeb are our production assistants and social media managers.
Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.